B-Pod Studios.
What are the new trends emerging quickly that impact our business? Who are the thought leaders bringing these new products to market? And what lessons in leadership can we bring to our everyday life? Beasley Media Group Executive Vice President of Strategy and Innovation, Buzz Knight, brings all of this to life with this podcast, Healthy Paranoia.
On this edition of Healthy Paranoia, Buzz Knight speaks with Michael Solomon, the author of Marketers Tear Down These Walls, Liberating the Postmodern Consumer. Michael is a professor in the Department of Marketing at St. Joseph's University in Philadelphia, and his insights of today's consumer gives us an interesting roadmap to navigating the challenges of marketing in today's noisy world. Now, here's Buzz Knight.
Michael Solomon, thanks for joining us here on Healthy Paranoia. I appreciate it.
Oh, my pleasure. Thanks for having me on the show.
So what was the motivation with your book, Marketers Tear Down These Walls? What got you most fascinated around the topic and how to liberate the postmodern consumer?
Well, I've been teaching and doing research and consulting and so on the topic of consumer behavior for, I hate to say it, about 30 years. And during that time, obviously, there's been a huge amount of change and disruption going on. And what I realized is that, you know, when you go back and revisit some of the really basic concepts that we teach students today, we have to revisit those because actually many of them are no longer valid. And so what I realized is that there are a number of what I call walls. So the title of the book, you know, Tear Down These Walls, the walls that we've erected. We love to put customers into tidy little categories. And in so doing, we think we understand them and we walk away happy. But the reality is that customers, people today don't like to be put into these categories, and they love to climb out of them. And they're not nearly as obedient as we'd like them to be. They don't always listen to what we want them to listen to, as I'm sure you realize. And so the book is really about identifying some of those basic categories and hopefully showing readers that they need to step back and question a lot of their assumptions about what makes people tick today.
And I love how you start it. Before we get into the categories, I'd love to hear about that. But I love how you talk about grab your sledgehammer, breach that wall that separates you from your customers. And then you give the profound advice, get out of your office and meet the people who love your brand. I love that because it's so grassroots.
Yeah, and it seems like, duh, common sense, you know, but the fact is, and I've seen this a lot of times in when I've worked with companies, you speak to the people who are dealing with customers, and they're imagining what they want their customers to be. You know, they're dealing with a customer who's their fantasy customer, and that doesn't necessarily match the reality on the ground. So yeah, management by walking around, we hear a lot about that. Well, it should be marketing by walking around as well.
And who are some companies, in your opinion, that really get that?
Well, you've got the usual suspects. You know, you've got Nike, you've got Apple. Everybody loves to talk about these guys. I think some of the clothing brands that are starting to shake free of old categories. Levi Strauss is one that I have worked with them over the years. I think they're doing a pretty good job of that. Honestly, most brands, traditional brands, are kind of still stuck back 10 years ago in terms of this. Everybody's trying to change. I don't want to say that they're not, but really, you know, in terms of understanding that it's the customer today who drives the train, it is not you, the marketer, that's a hard pill to swallow for a lot of people. But once you manage to do it, you realize there's a lot of opportunities, like we were saying, going out and talking with customers, getting your customers to sell for you. We know that's very powerful. And so the brands that are doing that really are, I think, seeing some success, especially in terms of dealing with the fabled millennials and Gen Zs and all the young people coming up that are going to change our world.
So talk about the various walls that you suggest are necessary for marketers to be breaking down?
Well, some of them are just standard demographics, like young versus old, rich versus poor, male versus female. These are largely obsolete, and we can see how that's working in our culture today. Lots of controversies about that. But when you think about the music and radio programming, for example, that people listen to, I think there's a lot more diversity there than we assume. And just by knowing that somebody is a 50-year-old male who lives in an urban area, blah blah blah, we don't necessarily know what he. Well, we may know what he's listening to, but we don't necessarily know what he wants to listen to if he has the choices available. So a lot of these walls relate to personalizing the content that you're getting. We can talk about walls in the music industry, but more generally, and one wall that's relevant there, I think, is the wall between producers and consumers. And obviously, the music industry is experiencing a shift just like others, other industries, where consumers are now becoming their own music producers. They're producing a lot of different products. They're suggesting ideas for products. They're creating their own promotional spots for products. So they're taking on a lot of the roles that traditional marketers play, and that where they think they have to be highly trained in order to do that. All it takes is a few clever people with a little bit of technology, and who knows, they might even be able to make a podcast someday that's about a tenth as good as yours. I hope not, but it could happen.
You're being very kind. And you defined the aspect of how consumers deal with this by calling it the omni-channel consumer. Can you talk about that?
Well, sure. We hear a lot of buzz these days. Oh, pardon the pun. We hear a lot of talk these days about omni-channel marketing, and that it's almost becoming a cliche, but it's of course a very valuable perspective, because it reminds us that when you're putting together a promotional mix, again, you've got to break down walls, and omni-channel means you've got to be wherever the customer is. And then if you take that argument a step further, we can talk about the omni-channel consumer, who is really, I guess you might say, finding the building blocks of his or her life in a lot of different places. And so what you have today are consumers who are not constrained, again, by these traditional walls, where they're going to find inspiration for their own lives. They're going to do a lot more sampling. So it kind of reminds me of, I'm no expert on hip-hop music, but when you talk about DJs who sample different pieces of music and put them together, that's the way I like to think of consumers today. They're constantly sampling lots of different things, and that means that your content can't just necessarily live in the traditional places where you think they're going to find it. You need to be wherever they are, because they're sampling 24/7. And of course, a lot of the sampling is being done for them by their so-called friends. In the old days, we had friends, we actually knew what they looked like and who they were. But today we have friends we've never met on Facebook and so on, but they're tremendously influential. So that whole curation process of, who gets to put together these little samples, who gets to be the DJ of your life? I think it's an interesting question for people in communications industries, because it says, on the one hand, we have the argument that, advertising is dead. Consumers are just going to make their own stuff, and we're not going to have a job in 5 years. And I don't think that's true, but with this omni-channel world, what it means to me is that, for example, a radio programmer or somebody like that I think of as a curator or a gatekeeper, their job is actually much more profound, because there's so much more content out there today. It's physically impossible for any consumers to actually process that. And so radio programmers, DJs, radio executives, in addition to their counterparts in other industries like in advertising and in food and fashion and so on, really have to think of themselves as cultural editors who are controlling this massive flow of information and making it much more manageable for people.
And then when you really talk about, you know, the degree of difficulty here and the importance of, you know, getting it right with content, the other thing that really, two points really stuck with me in the book. First of all, how you talk about the zero moment of truth factor, which is critical. And then the other one that you talk about is the post-purchase evaluation and how it's more expensive to acquire a new customer than to keep the old one. Can you talk about that?
Well, absolutely. You know, that's a lesson that everybody needs to revisit, you know, and this notion that the way your success is measured, you know, the metric that you use is how many customers you have. That's great. All things equal, I'd rather have more than less. But the real value lies in cultivating, you know, what we sometimes call the lifetime customer value of your existing customers, and recognizing that, you know, as you said, it's much more expensive to get every incremental new person because I'm starting from scratch with them. But if I've got, let's say, loyal listeners to a radio show, I mean, that is the best resource that you have ever. And of course, not only are they accounting for a large number of listening hours, you probably know the famous 80-20 rule, which is that 80% of your revenue comes from 20% of your customers, but they also are your best sales force. You know, they are your evangelists who are going, if they really believe in you, they have a lot of stake psychologically to justify the fact that, you know, you're their favorite program. And one way we rationalize our choices is by convincing other people that we made a great choice. So, you know, you've got this hardcore group of customers that you are already in your corner. And so many companies, I won't say ignore them, but they take them for granted and they just assume they're going to be, if they were here today, they're going to be here tomorrow. And they don't do enough to really just even reward them for their patronage, but even more importantly, involve them as partners in the process of generating new content. So, you know, what I like to say is in the old days, we marketed to people. And today, if we're smart, we market with people. And that little word, you know, going from to with, is an enormously different perspective on how you relate to your customers.
And the other part that really resonated in that is how you'd say follow up after the sale and vigorously court your customers. I love that.
Yeah, well, so many mindsets are transactional, where people say, well, my goal is to make a sale, and once I do that, ka-ching, I'm off to the golf course. And of course, you know, I mean, unless you're selling I was going to say Girl Scout cookies, but that is building a relationship or you know, capitalizing on one you already have. Almost everything we do is relationship selling, and you know, and certainly in the music industry and the radio business and so on, the sounds that come out of the radio should be your guide. You know, that should be your friend who's guiding you through all the complexities of life in one way or the other, either by curating the music for you, curating the news that you're hearing, just giving you advice. And so, it's all about lifetime value. And, of course, that means keeping track, obviously, of who these people are, you know, what their preferences are, so that not in a creepy way, so that, you know, you know everything about them necessarily, but you know enough to be dangerous. I mean, you know enough to be able to predict what they're going to do, because, you know, the best predictor of future behavior is past behavior. So the more I know about your pattern of listening, for example, the more educated my estimate will be about what you're going to want in the future, even if you don't necessarily know it yet.
And as you're talking about this, I'm thinking about the fact that you're in Philadelphia, and our company is the owner of one of the greatest stations in America, greatest rock stations, 93.3 WMMR in Philadelphia. And so much of what you talk about resonates as a result of how that station has, you know, thrived and prospered through many generations. I think you could probably agree as a member of that community, right?
Well, there's no question, you know, and especially today, I think if someone decides to consume their music via a traditional radio station, they're, in a sense, they're making a sacrifice and they're making a statement. In other words, what they're saying is, I'm going to, you know, in order to hear, let's say, the DJs that make a difference to me, I'm going to put up with the other things, and frankly, I'm going to put up with the advertising that I'm going to hear. And so when I say sacrifice, you know, I mean it in the sense that you're consciously willing to forego, you know, let's say a different modality with no ads in order to cultivate that relationship you have with a certain program. So, yeah, I mean, today I think a traditional, you know, a radio listener probably is very, very loyal to certain programs, to certain people on the radio. And obviously they're, you know, as you know, I think they're more loyal to the individuals than they are to the station. So if that person moves to a different station, you know what's going to happen.
Absolutely. How do you think radio can benefit from collaborative innovation?
Yeah, well, again, this is, you know, this is the wave of the future where we, you know, that wall comes down, as I mentioned, between producing and consuming. And so, you know, I'm going to interpret your question when you say collaborative. I'm going to assume you mean with working with listeners to create programming. Am I correct?
Or, sure. Yeah.
Yeah. So we know that personalization is, you know, I don't want to say it's the secret sauce, but it's one of them. You know, there's a lot of research that shows that when people play a role in literally constructing what they consume, they're much more loyal to it. Sometimes it's called the IKEA effect, meaning that, you know, if you build that bookcase, I don't know about you. I usually have a few nails left over. It's kind of scary, but if you build that bookcase as opposed to just buying it preassembled, you've invested more of yourself in it, and therefore you're going to be much more attached to that. So, if we can kind of extrapolate to your industry, we can assume that when people are able to play a more proactive role in determining the content that they will hear, their loyalty level is going to go through the roof. And so it could be, for example, curating playlists, doing more on traditional radio that you'll sometimes see on internet radio and so on, where listeners are contributing playlists to the station. And it could be a group of people who contribute that playlist. And, you know, it could even be a little competitive where you have, I don't know, three different groups submitting playlists, and then your listeners vote on who nailed it, you know. But that kind of collaboration, you know, not locking people out and, you know, saying, oh, we're going to surprise them tomorrow with what they're going to hear. Well, that's fine to a point. But I think when listeners feel that they're part of that community, and we use that word over and over, I don't want it to become too trite, but feeling that you're part of a community, and that's what happens with some of these popular stations like WMMR, you know, that there's just no substitute for that. Because at the end of the day, as you know, in today's world, the listener, you know, if they want to hear song X, they don't have to tune into your station to listen to it. That's not why they're tuning into your station. They're tuning in because they want to be part of something bigger, and they don't want to just be, so to speak, in the audience. They want to be on the stage as well, to some extent. So anytime you can ramp up your customer, your listener's level of engagement by actively soliciting and respecting their opinions, there's just you know, there's no limit in terms of the level of cohesiveness you'll create, which in turn leads to loyalty, which is the holy grail.
So when you observe marketing that goes on for radio stations, what do you generally observe?
Well, too many really bad commercials. But, you know, it's I think that the shows that really succeed, you know, the big advantage that radio has today is ironically that it's more high touch than high tech. In, you know, it's much more local. And so therefore, again, it becomes the voice of a community, you know, that could be expressed through words or through music or both. But I think the stations that really resonate with people are the ones that say, you know, we are the authentic voice of your community. And so we are your mouthpiece. We're not just some impersonal, you know, corporate entity that you're never going to get to know, and we could be broadcasting from New York City and, you know, you're in the heartland. We don't really care about you, and it's all just canned. So I think, again, that word personalization is so important. To the extent that you can customize the mix of content that you're providing and, again, make the listeners feel that they had a role in determining that.
So lastly, Michael, you have the boots on the ground in your role as a professor with the pulse of a generation. How should we be thinking about that generation that you're teaching, and how our industry and stations should reach them? Because it's a big question and a big concern for us as well.
I'd say be afraid, be very afraid. these kids, you know, they are different. Obviously, I'm generalizing, but clearly much shorter attention span for one. And so narrative programming is a problem, you know, where you're telling a story that has a beginning, a middle, and an end. They want to skip right to the end. And so what I found is, you know, and I have the same challenge in a sense that you do, you know, I have an audience that I'm trying to engage, and, you know, they could have that radio on but not be listening, and that's the way I feel when I lecture sometimes. So, again, you know, young people, what do they want? Well, they want authenticity, they want connection, they want what I call brand genealogy, which is they want to know the backstory. You know, when they choose to patronize a brand, whether it's a Whole Foods or whether it's a radio station, what have you, they're in it. They want to really know what is that station doing in the community. Maybe how are they promoting various charitable causes, et cetera. And I think local radio personalities do that quite well. You know, when they go out on promotions and so on, they enjoy that kind of thing. And again, you know, they live in a world of sampling where they have, it amazes me that, you know, they can literally call up any music that's been produced in the last, you know, 1,000 years, and it exists somewhere, you know, in some archive. So what they're looking for, again, is curation. I mean, I think it's useful to take a page. I always tell people, don't look at what your industry's doing, or just look at that. Look at what other industries are doing and the problems that they have. So take a look at, for example, the fashion industry, and I do a lot of work with people there. You know, who are the drivers in that industry? And it's not, of course, the old guard anymore. You know, it's not Vogue magazine anymore. It's some, you know, 18-year-old girl sitting in her bedroom and pulling stuff out of her closet and talking about it on a video. And so, again, that notion of curation of influencers is extremely important. So you've got certain tastemakers or influencers, whatever word you want to use, in your audience, and You know, they may be young people who don't have any formal radio experience, but in today's world, you know, they're radio executives are kind of, you know, you're kind of like the editor of Vogue magazine. You think you've got a lot of power, and you do, but the way you wield that power has to be very different today. And again, it has to be much more collaborative, as we've discussed. It has to be authentic. It has to focus on the backstory. So, you know, to the extent that, I mean, life is a podcast to these kids. And so you need to think of it that way, that they're constantly tuning in and out of your podcast, and you need to give them the justification to do that, because obviously they have so many other choices out there. So involving them more proactively in the programming decisions you make, even inviting them to be guest DJs or however you structure that, is probably worth a shot.
Michael Solomon, thank you for the time today on Healthy Paranoia.
Oh, thanks for having me on.
This has been Healthy Paranoia with Buzz Knight and today's guest, Michael Solomon, author of Marketers Tear Down These Walls, Liberating the Postmodern Consumer.
Thanks for listening to Healthy Paranoia with Buzz Knight. Production assistance provided by Boston Beasley Media Group's Mark Clark.
BackstageCountry.com, your online home for all things country music. Picking five of Carrie Underwood's best music videos was no easy task, but after some debate, we landed on five we believe rise to the top. Did Carrie's 2014 hit Something in the Water make our top five? Find out when you text Carrie to 45911 and scroll through the list on BackstageCountry.com. Text Carrie to 45911 to get your eyes on our favorite Carrie Underwood music videos.